Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Building the Ballot. It's Hall of Fame announcement day, so we had to jump right on a podcast. I'm Adam Dorowski, your host, and realize I never really introduced myself. I'm product director at Baseball Reference by day. Sports Reference. Baseball Reference is one of several things we make, and apparently a podcaster by night. So I'm joined here right after the announcement, like minutes after the announcement, with Cooperstown Dave, Dave Metter. How are you doing, Dave?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, Adam.
Well, thank you so much for suggesting we hop right on this podcast, because I was not even thinking about it, and I was thinking about what we were going to do next. We actually do have a pretty cool episode coming up in the not too distant future. Not with Dave, with a couple new faces for the podcast, so I'm excited about it. But today we are here to talk about the results of the Contemporary Baseball Era Committee announcement. This is the non-players ballot. Dave, do you just want to tell everyone what happened to start things off?
Sure. Jim Leland, longtime manager of a few ball clubs, was elected to the Hall of Fame with 15 votes out of a possible 16. He needed only 12 to get in. So he clears the 75% threshold with a rather big number on his first opportunity on a ballot as well. The rest of the outcome was Lou Piniella with 11 votes for the second cycle in a row. So he falls one vote shy of election. Bill White, longtime executive and former player, got 10 votes, and everyone else on the ballot got less than 5. And that would be umpires Ed Montague, Joe West, executive Hank Peters, and managers Cito Gaston and Davey Johnson. And did I forget somebody?
No, I think that's everyone. So Okay. That... a little bit of a surprising result. I thought we would get more than one name. I'm curious about your reaction.
You know, so yeah, I'm trying to just kick off with the positive, but it's great. We have a new Hall of Famer. It's right. One that I think is very worthy. And but yes, I think we all, for different reasons, expected more than one. On the other hand, I think that while the Hall of Fame in many ways has seen progress, we need to be vigilant in remembering that typically these things do go slow and in smaller drips. There was that cycle where Torrey, La Russa, and
Cox
all got in on one, but really that's not the norm necessarily. So we got one where I think there was more surprise was we tend to often think, well, Lou Piniella fell only one vote short last time. He's going to get that 12th vote and get in. But the electorate changes for these cycles, so it's not like you're dealing with the same exact pool of people. There's also the Dick Allen precedent, let's call it, which is Dick Allen's already established that you can get 11 votes in two cycles. So that's unfortunate. We're talking about with him and Bill White, who got 10 votes, who it did seem there was a bit of a groundswell of interest in Bill White, which is very exciting, especially to me as somebody who really wanted to see him be elected. But with White and Piniella and Leland, they're alive. They're still with us. They're at an advanced age. It's a little disappointing to see them not get in, especially since they seem like people who, especially now with White getting 10 votes, that's by far the most he's gotten. So it's a little disappointing, but we got one. It's better than zero. There have definitely been years we had zero. So I think that might be the feeling that most people have, but that's me just also being a bit self-centered, assuming everyone feels like I do.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that Piniella once again got 11. I was scrolling through like the history of the era committee votes. And since 2015, there's been quite a few candidates to get 11, which is like the one vote shy. So I guess going back to 2013, Bill Dahlen was two votes shy. So starting in 2015, we had Dick Allen and Tony Oliva, both one vote shy. And then in 2016, Doc Adams was two votes shy. The next year, we had Schuerholz and Selig unanimously. We had Ted Simmons in 2018, one vote shy. Then we had 2019, the next year, Lou Piniella was one vote shy that year. 2020, that did not happen. In 2021, there was no 2021 election. There were two in 2022. The early baseball did not have a 11 out of 16, though Vic Harris was 10 out of 16. And the Golden Days era, four candidates got in, but we still had Dick Allen again with the 11 out of 16. And then last year was the one induction with Fred McGriff. So 11 out of 16 seems to happen pretty often. And they don't necessarily get in the year after, like Simmons did. I think they tend to
eventually get in. I think off the top of my head, I know I've looked this up before. I think at the moment, Allen and now Pinella are the only ones that didn't eventually get in. The only sort of qualifier in that I'd throw out is when the system, when the electorate was a smaller number. So I'm trying to look, but I think there were years where you needed 9 out of 12. And that there were some where people got 8 and have yet to get in. But in the 16 vote format, I believe what I've shared is right. Like Herzog and Doug Harvey both got 11 votes, but they're already in.
Yeah, in 2010, John Fetzer had 8 out of 12, which John Fetzer is a name that I have not seen since.
I can tell you it's both a last name and first name. But yeah, he's an executive case that hasn't come back around for whatever reason. So it's tough. You know, I'm sure for Lou Piniella, who's had a great career, this is disappointing. For Bill White and his family and whoever people, everyone has, it's disappointing. But it's amazing for Jim Leland. Jim Leland, you know, is very meritorious. He won a World Series. He won 3 pennants. I'm not sure how much precedent off the top of my head there is to win 3 pennants and not end up in the Hall of Fame. There are a couple of cases. There's Negro League managers for sure. There's Ralph Houk. But it's otherwise quite rare. A lot of the talk was centered leading up to this around Piniella, I think, just because he had 11 votes in that last time. This was Leland's debut. And while I think most people thought, oh, he'll eventually get in, it was a little unclear if it would be so quick. But to get 15 out of 16 is also like rather impressive. So the other thing is, from what we see, I'm somebody on Twitter who talks a lot about the ERA committee's rules and Rule B, which dictates that when you evaluate a candidate, you're not supposed to look at them only within the category that they've been shoved into for the sake of the Hall of Fame voting process. So Lou Piniella was also a player, but for Hall of Fame sake, they're looking at him mainly as a manager, but you look at his playing too. But with that in mind, knowing that Davey Johnson had a very good playing career, Lou Piniella had a very good playing career, Jim Leland didn't have a major league playing career. So that factor didn't really tip the scales, but really given the details of their resumes, again, Jim Leland had a very comfortable Hall of Fame career either way.
Yeah, I'll jump back to that 3 pennants thing that you mentioned. And you're right. Like you mentioned Ralph Houk, Charlie Grimm had 3 pennants and has not gotten in. But other than that, you're looking at 4 candidates from the Negro Leagues, which, of course, famously, there are no managers in from the Negro Leagues. But Frank Warfield, Candy Jim Taylor, and Dave Mularcher each had 3. And, of course, Vic Harris had 7, which should just put an exclamation point next to his case as well, which will be evaluated next year. But yeah, in terms of Jim Leland, did not have the playing career. So what do we have on Baseball Reference for his minor league playing career? So he was a catcher, I believe. Yep. And he played 7 seasons in the minors and hit 222, 319 OBP. You always see OBP from a manager. Well, not that 319 is high, but it's a lot higher than 222. Right. And then 261 slugging. So that's what Jim Leland looked like playing in the Detroit system. So nice to see that he was able to come back to Detroit there as well.
Yeah, he had a long career with that franchise. I think also there's Jim Mutry, who was a 19th century player manager who won a couple of, let's call them, World Series in the late 1880s. But that's literally everybody who won anything close to around the amount of pennants that Jim Leland did. So he's in. Something that piqued my interest when hearing he was elected was the fact that when you look at Jim Leland's career, he won his 1 World Series with the Marlins. But he had most of his managerial time with the Detroit Tigers. He won two pennants there. So if he gets a logo on his plaque, as opposed to having a blank cap, it's almost certainly going to be the Tigers. And Adam and I quickly looked this up, but it would be the first time that a manager's Hall of Fame plaque, if the manager won a World Series, will be of the logo of not the team they won the World Series with. I said that in a very difficult way, but we'll see what happens. Maybe he'll go with a blank cap, but there's a good chance he'll be the first manager to have won a World Series in the Hall of Fame with a logo on his cap that is not the team he won the World Series with. One other thing that I'm now curious about as well is, again, everybody's obsessed with the Hall of Fame, but then certain details everyone kind of dismisses. People love the logo, but they don't even tend to care about the text. So will it mention that he won a World Baseball Classic? Because that would certainly break new ground. Jim Leland is the only manager to win a World Series and a World Baseball Classic. And it was the World Baseball Classic win was referenced in the press release the Hall of Fame put out when they announced this ballot. So seeing if they include that in the limited text on the plaque, though the last many years they allow way more characters than they used to, could signal just greater interest by Major League Baseball and the Hall of Fame in the enterprise of the World Baseball Classic and how we maybe integrate those games and series in Hall of Fame discussions.
Yeah, I'm very excited to see that come up so much during the discussions about the candidates, because you know, I love international baseball. I think that's one of the things that has been reinvigorated with, like, for years and years I followed only baseball, but then I took a turn into soccer and kind of fell in love with soccer. And now coming back to baseball with that international look has been eye-opening for me. And I thought the World Baseball Classic this last time was the most amazing baseball tournament I'd ever seen. So, well, maybe not 2004 World Series. I shouldn't forget about that. But anyway, I'm excited to see the World Baseball Classic come up in these discussions a little bit more, because I think acknowledging that baseball exists outside of, you know, the 50 states and Toronto is a good thing.
Yeah, and I admittedly don't know a lot about the past history of Olympic baseball. I've read there's talk of trying to bring back baseball to the Olympics, how that would jive, when would that occur, who would participate, would it be professionals or maybe not, for America is unclear. But the World Baseball Classic is so part of, I don't know the real business machinations of it, but it seems like MLB runs it. Maybe runs isn't the correct verb exactly, but given that and MLB's relationship with the Hall of Fame, that could portend that it's rather ends up connected and involved. And so in a way, you know, to me, that really was a major possible signal in the press release ahead of all this. Now the next step will it be on a plaque? And another thing we always see with these plaques, probably won't be anything I can think of as it relates to Leland, but moving forward, will we, you know, each step towards newer sabermetrics and advanced analytics, will we see them referenced on certain plaques? Is that just a whole nother thing that we likely will eventually see? But yeah, back to this, I mean, please take over your podcast.
I want to throw a question here to you. We got a couple of questions in. One's from MLB Swag Index, and a little bit of a juicy question here. So he says, here's one. Is there any point in putting Pinella, Johnson, and Gaston on the ballot anymore? They didn't match up well with Leland, and they won't match up well with Bochy, Baker, or Francona either. And of course, that's referring to the fact that the next time this cycle comes through, Dusty Baker, Bruce Bochy, and Terry Francona are all going to be on the ballot. So good luck to whoever fills out the rest of that ballot.
It's a great question. I think the answers differ on the individuals respectively. So Lou Piniella, look, he fell one vote shy. I believe twice. I believe Doc Adams fell two votes shy and then did not appear the next time he could have. So even if you get a really high number, it doesn't necessarily mean you come back. But 11's quite high, and there's more, I think, interest in among the masses in Lou Piniella than Doc Adams, who most people think probably has an MD. But so we're talking in 2023. Of course, this is referred to as the 2024 class. the next time this format of the committee comes around will be the 2027 class. And yes, we're expecting Bochy, Baker, Francona, probably Brian Sabian debuts, or Dave Dombrowski. Mike Socha could have debuted this year but didn't appear. And whether or not you think he's a Hall of Famer, he's certainly the caliber of baseball person that would be on a ballot. And Theo Epstein could possibly. So there's about seven, and that's minimum to me, of people who are absolutely worthy of appearing on a ballot. And they're now just being added onto the group that already could have existed, just minus one person, that's Jim Leland. So that's one reason why I would have liked to see more people get in, even just in the abstract, not even talking about the individuals of who would be getting in. So that's going to be a challenge for that next cycle. I think that Pinella got 11 votes twice. To think that we set him aside, I think's unrealistic. Gaston and Johnson, you know, again, I'm not trying to put down anyone's candidacy. There could be a difference also. We don't know. Did one of these guys get four votes as opposed to zero? There's a big difference there. Gaston, this is his first opportunity. Maybe he shouldn't really be cast aside. I'm not suggesting we cast aside Davey Johnson, but he's appeared now quite a few times, and he's never really gotten any traction. So I think, because we have to just be adults here, there's limited spots, there's a lot of candidates. I think that come 2027, Davey kind of probably has to like fall off. So, I mean, we're going to get seven or so really compelling candidates, and you can't keep having on. And the person who is in charge of the Historical Overview Committee, Jack O'Connell, has said if somebody appears on the ballot many times and isn't getting traction, we put them aside. And maybe that is going to have to happen with Davey Johnson.
Yeah, I think that even though I think if I had a vote, Davey might have gotten one of my three votes. But at the same time, you know, this is like eight times on the ballot for him, and he hasn't gotten close at all. So I think that it is time to, especially with this upcoming group of candidates, to take a little break, you know, let some of the backlog clear, and then maybe it's time to look at Davey Johnson again. I might be a little surprised if Gaston does make the next one too, with that group coming in. I think we might see that, like that same year that Torrey, Cox and La Russa came in, like they're kind of expecting these three candidates to come in and buzz right through, maybe even Sabian too. I'm not sure exactly how his candidacy works, but he might be on there as well. Yeah. And then maybe we look at, you know, let the speedsters go through, and then we'll reevaluate the non slam dunks later.
Yeah. Go ahead. No, I was just going to add that I just completely agree. It's just, I also think, given the caliber of these incoming candidates, that I would think it's a very good chance Lou Piniella's number goes down that time, just because how do you not vote for Bruce Bochy? And I mean, if Theo Epstein's on that ballot, I mean, my gosh, how do you not vote? Given the accomplishments he did with the particular franchises he was with, it was so historic and exciting. So it's just the ballot crunch. It's what we deal with.
Yeah, that's a good point. There's only 64 votes to go around. And if three candidates are sucking a lot of those votes in one direction, it doesn't leave much to go around.
And the other part is, we know that, let's say we really could objectively show the best eight candidates are managers. We're going to get a ballot that's a combination of the three categories, manager, executive, umpire, no matter what, most likely. So I think you assume at least one spot goes to a manager. Joe West is bound to come back around. But so it's not even like we're trying to just fill in the eight spots with all the names we're saying. Think of it as more like six or seven, because umpires are going to get a shot.
Speaking of Joe West, you shared something ahead of the election that I thought was super fascinating, where Joe West was the first umpire to be suspended during the season for pushing a manager. And lo and behold, who is on the committee that's voting for him in the Hall of Fame? That manager, which is Joe Torrey. I don't know how much this impacted things, but I did say in our podcast ahead of this that that Joe West is either going to go 16 out of 16 or he's going to be under whatever many votes. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah. I was thinking the same thing, that it wouldn't shock me if he gets 15 votes or under three or whatever they say. Mm-hmm. And I would suspect, you know, for a number of years now, Joe Torre has held, or maybe he doesn't as of now, but for many years, he held a position in Major League Baseball of an executive nature whose title I do not know. I think it technically oversaw things like umpiring. I don't know exactly how he was involved, but Joe West also held certain higher level roles, I believe, in Major League Baseball regarding umpiring. And I say that all to say that perhaps all of that that happened to them a billion years ago is sort of water under the bridge. But yeah, maybe not. So I agree. I had the same thought. It is interesting that it was the first time an umpire was suspended mid-season. And it was this whole thing where really it seems like both West and Torre were maybe both in the wrong a bit. On the other hand, it's interesting. Of course, it was Joe West of all people. It just happened to be. So, yeah, but I think, you know, West is inevitable. And that also could be my album title. West is inevitable. Sounds cool. But were there more questions?
Yeah, I have another question from Zekin's dad on Twitter and somebody that I know from my Out of the Park Baseball League many, many years ago. So hello, Zekin's dad. So he asks, and if you know him, which I do, maybe the most predictable way to format this question is, when will Munson get another chance? Of course, he's a big Yankee fan, big Thurman Munson fan. So I'm going to pivot that question to be, let's look forward a little bit and think about how this next ballot could be constructed. So this is the classic baseball, and classic sounds old, but Thurman Munson is a classic baseball era candidate. It's from the beginning of time to 1980. It's players, it's managers, it's executives, it's umpires, it's pioneers, it's candidates from the Negro Leagues that have been overlooked for so many years. And there's eight spots. Before we even go into the candidates, how do you think that it might break down? Like, this one had four managers, two executives and two umpires. How do you think the spaces might be allocated?
It's so complex. There's also, because you also kind of have to think of time period, I think would become a thing. Because let's say that there's that ballot and it turned into four players, two managers, whatever this exact breakdown was. It can't just be only people from post 1950, because that just would probably be odd. And then there's the Negro Leagues, which I'm not trying to separate in a negative way. It's just the reality of, I think, wanting to honor them. So we're bound to see, I would hope, at minimum one Negro Leagues individual. It's going to be complex because, yes, you're going to look at Thurman Munson, but you're also going to look at Doc Adams, and you're going to look at John Donaldson or, you know, Vic Harris, who knows? Again, I would just say that maybe one umpire, and that I think in a way with that, it's good to start with what you probably know. Like, when it came to this last cycle, I think we know Lou Piniella was going to be on. So then you just get rid of a spot, and you know it's also being a manager. So, for example, with this ballot, I think it hopefully should be safe to say Dick Allen's getting a spot. So that's one player spot, and now we have seven to play with, and know that we already used one for a player. And then I would think Vic Harris gets a spot, given he did really well. No guarantees, but all right, so now we got two down and we've got one manager, and it's one Negro Leagues manager. And that's how I kind of start to think it through.
I'm just going through here and wondering if you can actually make a ballot out of only candidates who have already gotten 50% on one of these votes. And you don't have to go back very far. Vic Harris, John Donaldson, Dick Allen, Doc Adams, Bill Dahlen, Harry Stovey, Maury Wills. We're already at seven and I haven't gone back that far. And these are all candidates.
Stovey got 50%.
In 2016, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So that's going to be so fun to pick apart and try to figure up, and also so frustrating because I'm sure Kurt Flood isn't on that list, but the amount of energy that myself and many other people have to want to see Kurt Flood get his due is tremendous. And I think just given the nature of progress in the world that occurs, that can't be ignored forever, just how Marvin Miller couldn't have been ignored forever. And the times caught up with the resistance to Marvin Miller.
Yeah.
So, there's no Negro Leagues umpire. So mm-hmm. how'd that work? But then there's also Emmett Ashford, who is a very significant, interesting figure in Major League Baseball. So there's just so many things.
Yeah. Just to complete that thought, like era committee only, Dave Concepcion and Danny Murtaugh, you can add to that. So that's over eight right there. And I assume Dwight Evans would be a post 1980 just because his career is pretty evenly split, but he was a bigger star in the 80s. So I assume he would be in the more modern group. They're probably doing anything they can to pull candidates over into the post 1980 anyway, just because pre 1980 is so stacked. So yeah, that's eight candidates, right? Nine candidates, sorry. So we'd already have to trim some.
Yeah. And I know that seems like maybe, again, I'm projecting just my interest, but will Felipe Alou somehow be put into that era through pioneer or player? Because again, a lot of people are really interested in him and he didn't get to make this past cycle. I mean, you certainly know a lot of we're not going to go through all the players. That could be another day, but a long day, but there's a lot of Negro Leagues players. There's several Negro Leagues managers. Again, there's no umpires that have been yet to be in. There are a couple executives. Gus Greenlee is kind of, he was an interesting character, and maybe that's why he's not in. But with Cumberland Posey's in, I don't really fully get why Gus Greenlee isn't in. And there's others that are worth considering. And then you go to just, I feel like you can't forever see people over 60 WAR not in. I'm thinking like Bill Dolan. So there's going to be a lot of people, and I look forward to wishing I get to be a part of the committee that makes that ballot, but I'll never be on it. And it would be a blast to deal with that incredibly painful experience.
Would you want to be on that committee? I would find it so painful to have to limit it to eight. But not only that, limit it to eight, but then know that six of them at least probably will not get in.
I would, because I would really think it through in terms of I kind of favor at times the idea of making sure there's one or two people who I don't think will get as many votes, so maybe votes can go elsewhere. But now I'm disagreeing in my head because I don't want, like, we don't need Allie Reynolds for the 300th time. You know what I mean? So, I don't know how many people really are dying for Ewing Kaufman or John Fetzer. It's great that Ewing Kaufman had a pharmaceutical empire and started the Royals, and somebody had just, that's really cool that people do these things, but I don't think that's as much of what we all are going to the Hall of Fame and talking about baseball and going on Baseball Reference for. So yeah, I would do it. I'm available. At Cooperstown Dave.
You heard it here first. I mean, I admit I have colleagues who were in this vote who have voted for Rookie of the Year, and I wondered, do I want any part of this? Should that be something that I seek? And I don't know yet. I don't know.
Well, what are your other thoughts on do you have any other thoughts on what happened tonight? Because, again, I think with every Hall of Fame cycle, whether it's committee or BBWAA, the discourse tends to go negative. And it's hard not to be negative on this, since I think a lot of us got our hopes up for more than one. But I think a lot of people were worried that if it was just one or any, that it's going to be an umpire they don't want, whose last name isn't East. But so, to me, it's mainly disappointing because I feel bad for the individuals who are still alive, who, are older. And then there's going to be this much larger number of incredibly compelling and worthy candidates that are going to take up spots. So it's a shame we couldn't get some out, like more out than one.
For me, this was the rare Hall of Fame election where I felt like I really had no dog in the fight, if you know what I mean. Like, there wasn't a single candidate that I was like, this candidate has to be in. All of them were compelling in their own way. So I was just kind of watching the discourse to see what would happen. I think it would have been cool from a Rule B perspective, which I don't know. Somebody got me really hooked on this Rule B stuff. I don't know who. I think it might have been you. the Rule B side of things made me really interested in seeing how White and Johnson might be perceived. And another thing that I really liked about this was that all but one of the candidates were living. So there was a lot on the line here. Like usually these committees are looking at players that are long gone. And while it is wonderful to let the families celebrate these players, it's always great when you can actually honor them while they're alive. So, you know, I think for that reason, even though I wasn't overwhelmed by the candidates, I was looking for the maximum number of inductees. Because I think there are a lot of eventual Hall of Famers on this ballot, even if it's not the most compelling era committee ballot we've ever seen. I think this is going to be the lightest for a long time. Because when they split into the three committees, you know, this is the one that has the smallest jurisdiction, so to speak, fewest number of years and no players. Like I have said probably on several episodes now, I think it would have been better off if the managers, executives, and umpires from all time were one ballot. And that way I think Vic Harris coasts in on this ballot. And now we're not, you know, fighting about Vic Harris anymore, because I think we can all agree he's a slam dunk Hall of Famer. You know, maybe someone like Gus Greenlee even goes in as well. And there was room on this ballot, but starting now, there's not going to be.
Yeah, and the danger with this monster of a ballot that comes next year is it could be just so competitive, no one gets in because everybody's worthy and the votes get spread out. But I would say that I also didn't really have a dog in this fight, which is why, in a way, just in the abstract, I was hoping multiple would get in to free up bandwidth. But at the same time, the more I looked at Bill White, the more interested I got. I'm increasingly appreciative of great defensive first baseman, which is a spot where, you know, defense doesn't tend to get a lot of kudos. And just he had a great playing career. And then he did a lot of really, really great things. You know, it's tricky because you know, these things are harder to quantify. We want to quantify everything. And it's even the things you quantify, like pennants, it becomes the debate of, well, how much credit do you give for the World Series win to the players versus the manager versus the GM versus the owner? But like things Bill White did really go beyond that and open up doors for others. And even though he didn't get in, I do see it as a progress, because he got 10 out of 12 votes, which is around 83%. The previous times he was on the ballot, he got less than 3 when he needed 12. The other times he got 29.3% and 27.8%. These are small groups, so how much can he put into percentages and the electorate changes? But now at least, you know, it's established that Bill White one time got 10 out of 12 votes. So that really kind of ups the cachet of
10 out of 16, right?
Yeah, sorry, 10 yeah. out of a needed, he needed 12. 10 out of 16. It kind of just increases the merit of the perception of his candidacy, I think. The perception of his merit. So I think we all want, in a lot of areas in life, progress overnight. Doesn't always happen. And I also really was interested in his because I'm very keen on the whole Rule B thing. And I would like to see that progress, although I was very bearish on the idea. I think Davey Johnson said so many times, and it's just the needle hasn't moved. I was kind of almost surprised he got in on the ballot at all this time. But we got a Hall of Famer.
Question. I told you this was going to be a quick episode, but I just keep talking to you. So question about Bill White. And I think you mentioned this on the last episode. The Hall of Fame does have this Buck O'Neill Award for players for candidates who, I guess, like you said, their closest thing to like a lifetime achievement. And the past awards being given to Buck O'Neill, of course, being the first, but then Roland Hemond, Joe Garagiola, Rachel Robinson. And I admit the last few years, I haven't paid as much attention to this award, but David Montgomery and Carl Erskine won the last two in 2020 and 2023. Is this award something that's perfect for the career of Bill White, or should it be Hall of Fame? I don't know.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I was mostly just stumbling over it. I I'm not sure, because like a lot of what he did is as a broadcaster, and that's not one of the categories. So I'm not sure what to think.
Yeah, I feel like I don't have as much of a feel of the Buck O'Neill Award. There have been so few award winners that it's sort of like, how do you evaluate a Hall of Fame umpire? Well, if there's only 10, there's not a lot of data there for comparative analysis. But at the same time, those who were, Buck O'Neill won the award before he ever got in the Hall of Fame, right? Obviously, he was technically the first winner of the award that is named for him. So
right.
You could win that award and still be a Hall of Famer, is for one thing my point. The other is, other people who have won, I'm not really sure that they, by the nature of what they did, or, you know, I would like to see Roland Thiemann considered for the Hall of Fame. I think Bill White maybe could be considered for this, but he seems to me somebody Hall of Fame worthy, not just the Buck O'Neill, not to put down the Buck O'Neill Award. It's a wonderful thing, but I did see there's another question that came in on Twitter that I could put out there.
Oh, yeah, go for it.
So it comes from Jerry Liu, who asked, is whether the Hall of Fame is going to make changes to the voting format again, because these results are certainly bound to create more tragedies like the one we are seeing just now. And I assume what he's referring to is the disappointment of seeing people in it, because Mr. Liu has messaged me before, and I know that, like many, we want to see living people get in while they're alive. And I mean, my quick announcement, it would be like, look, they change the rules a lot of times, anytime they want. But there seems to be the recurring theme that even if they're trying to make strides to get people in while they're alive, that it's really hard to get in the Hall of Fame. What's your reaction to just the whole concept and the question?
Yeah, I think that you had mentioned in the last episode that this one seems pretty locked in for at least another cycle, because they've announced like the years that they're doing it. And usually they commit to like a couple cycles through. I also feel that this is probably the best era committee format that they've had, aside from that one tweak that I would have made, which was most impactful this time around. It's not as impactful anymore, because now you would have Vic Harris going up against Terry Francona, and you know, just so many of the umpires we mentioned earlier, Dusty Baker and Bruce Bochy. But other than that, I feel like, you know, I love the Negro Leagues. It's obviously an area of research that I've been throwing my entire self into lately. So I would love to see a special committee for that, but I know that that's not likely. So coming short of that, I think this is the best format that we could ask for, besides my one tweak I would still make. But anyway, so I don't anticipate huge changes to the voting rules when the next round finishes up. I do wonder if the smaller ballot size went from 10 to 8 and the fewer votes went from 4 to 3 was a reaction to that Golden Days era in 2022 of 4 candidates getting in and a 5th, Dick Allen, falling a vote shy. I don't know if that was a direct response of that. That group, I would love to be a fly on that wall. I feel like they probably were like, all right, who are we voting for? And we wanted to make sure we get as many candidates as possible, quite frankly, as they had the right to. Yeah, but I don't see any huge changes coming, unless it's to maybe go back to the 10 player ballots and 4 votes if they feel they're not getting enough candidates in.
Yeah, when it comes to the idea of getting people in while they're alive, they could. And again, I'm not trying to suggest that there's any reason to think they will or are or would. They could shift some of the details of the rules about, for example, with executives. You can continue to be working as an executive until you're 120 years old, but I think it's after you're 70 or 75, you become eligible. They could do something like that with managers so that Bruce Bochy could have been eligible this year, for example. So there are ways to tweak other rules, because with managers, you need to be retired, is my point.
Is that... I thought that there was an age that they don't have to, but I might.
There's an age where you.
Oh, and it's only 6 months, right?
Right. There's so if you have it up, I can't think of the quickest way to say this coherently, but it's like you have to be retired for at least 5 years unless you're a certain age, and then you only have to have been retired for 6 months, which is, of course, kind of a time period that fits neatly with sort of within, like, when does a season end? But with executives, you because, look, an executive might be an owner who owns the team for 1,000 years. So you kind of have to do it with that, but why not allow managers? Tony La Russa got in the Hall of Fame, and then he went back out there, didn't he?
It's true.
So Joe Torre was a manager, and then he worked as an executive. So that would be a way that could be interesting. It's just going to make the ballots more competitive sooner, though. So I think as much as we all want a lot more flexibility and more people in more quickly, that if we take a step back and remember part of the reason that this Hall of Fame is kind of the most discussed and heralded is it's not as easy as some others, and it's always been kind of tough, and it allows us to have something to talk about and debate and be frustrated over, and that's sometimes a feature, not a bug.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because the issue, of course, is like all of these rule changes, what would people want? They want more people to get inducted, but I'm not sure if that's what everybody, like, including the Hall of Fame, wants, because, you know, if suddenly you induct everybody, then there's nobody else left. And, you know, what's the discussion going to be there? But the number of candidates that are getting in now, they're getting enough to have interesting inductions, and there's still enough on the outside that there's these great debates and, you know, people with a lot of things they should be doing instead are starting podcasts just to discuss, you know, these types of things and, you know, talking about, you know, owners from the 1800s and managers from the 1930s, just, you know, and anybody from history that, you know, I don't know. I think, as you said, it's by design that things are kind of moving at this pace. I think they tweak things a little bit every few years if they feel it's slowing down or speeding up. Like I said, after the 2022, I think that they might have, you know, corrected to get fewer votes to go around. But yeah, but can you argue with the fact that, like, everybody's really, really interested and really invested in the Baseball Hall of Fame? You know, if it was too bad in one way or the other, like too many people getting in or not enough people getting in, people would be frustrated and would check out, but they're not doing that. So people are engaged.
And I think that the Hall of Fame knows that it benefits them and everybody to not have classes of zero people, because that has occurred, and it's kind of a PR disaster. It's a business disaster. There's nothing positive. So there's a balance that needs to be struck. I also imagine they know, let's say they only get one inductee and it's someone from 1900 who's not with us, that seeing someone give a speech who's not the actual person elected is probably a little less compelling. But erring a little bit on the side of more friction than not has worked rather well. And to circle back to Leland, just because I'm looking at the numbers, one thing that I do find very positive about the nature of his election, which, I mean, he got in on his first ballot. He got 15 votes out of 16. Although, on the other hand, to the point I'm about to make, Lou Piniella continues to be stuck at 11, is that these are managers who, by the standards of Hall of Fame managers, have somewhat light of resumes, but really only because of expansion. So they don't have, it's not as easy for them to win a bunch of pennants. So when I look at Jim Leland's numbers, and all of these things would hold true for Lou Piniella, he's a little below the Hall of Fame manager average for games managed and wins and World Series and pennants. Now, he's above the managerial Hall of Fame average for playoff appearances, but that's the other side of this coin, right? More teams get in the playoffs, so you're going to get more playoff appearances.
Right.
But in a way, these are concepts that we kind of think about with the players, with pitching wins or things where the game changes, the system changes, and we hope that the Hall of Fame evolves with it. And so while, of course, we're going to see managers get in the Hall of Fame, I think the pace at which Leland got in and that 15 out of 16 is a nice little signal towards, all right, we have a sense that we're going to adjust for managers, but that may also not be the point because perhaps the people voting aren't even thinking in these detailed terms and they just were out there and they know Jim Leland. He won some pennants and that was a Hall of Fame manager when I was out there. So just gave a really great point only to tear it down more quickly than I shared it.
Well, I think one point that you made that's really great is, you know, before 1969, playoff appearances and pennants won were synonyms. And now they've diverged where, you know, the playoff appearances are easier to come by because more teams make the playoffs. But as a result of that, it's much harder to win that pennant because there's a lot more competing for it. And I think you got to think about, you know, MVP awards and stuff like that in that respect too. Like it's a lot harder to get an MVP award or a gold glove, gold gloves in particular. Like, can you imagine like when there were 16 teams, there was a very high percentage of the league that was winning a gold glove and it's much smaller today.
Or leading a league in something. There's so many things. But we got one, it's better than nothing. We look forward to Jim Leland's induction day and we are looking forward in a couple months to the ballot that people are most interested in. And we see the BBWAA ballot results, which the voters have their ballots and they're casting them now and sending them by postal service still and hoping that they get delivered. And when it comes to, that next committee ballot, that's going to be fun to talk about, more fun than this one, frankly. But I had a really great time. I really appreciate you having me on this podcast a few times. I took an interest in these types of candidacies. It turned out to be really fun for me, and I got to hang out with people like yourself more, and I learned a lot. And I'm really excited for all the ballots to come.
Well, I really appreciate you coming on at such short notice tonight, literally minutes after the announcement. So, and thanks to the folks who posted some questions on Twitter, led to some good stuff for us to discuss. And the Building the Ballot podcast will be back probably within a couple of weeks with something a little bit different to tide us over. Maybe something that kicks off the next voting season, but maybe something that serves as a good little intermission between the voting seasons. We're going to be talking about some candidates who are maybe a little off the beaten path. So keep an eye out for that, and we'll have a couple fun guests to introduce you to then. And until then, thank you all for listening. You can find Dave on Twitter at Cooperstown Dave. Be sure to follow him there. Some great stuff there. I am on Twitter at Baseball Twit. Maybe some less great stuff there, but still trying. No.
It's great. And everyone's very thankful for the Immaculate Grid and everything you do there.
I didn't make up the Immaculate Grid.
I for anyone who follows me, they probably, and it took me this long, but I'm going to say the name Charlie Bennett on this podcast, and that he's, I think, has maybe the most WAR of any player who still hasn't been able to be used in the Immaculate Grid. And indeed, I look forward to the day when he can be used.
I'm just trying to track down a Detroit Wolverines logo and then we all can get him in there.
Well, maybe
we'll drop the 40 WAR to like 38.3 and that way he could match with like a 300 season or something.
Awesome.
All right, Dave, you have a great one, man.
You too. Thanks.
Bye-bye.